Welcome to podcast number 71 for Thanks for Your Service. Our focus is on historical topics relating to the Australian military. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Thanks for Your Service. Our website is www.thanksforyourservice.net, and you can also email us at info@thanksforyourservice.net. This month, March 2024, marks the 80th anniversary of the Great Escape. Many people have heard about the mass escape of Allied POWs from Stalag Luft 3 in March 1944, which was immortalised in book and film. You may not know a lot about the Australian POWs who took part. Canberra author Kristen Alexander joins us to tell us more. And joining us on the line from Canberra is author Kristen Alexander. Many thanks for joining us again.
No, thank you for inviting me, David.
We last spoke with you for our November 2023 podcast, number 68, on your book, which was titled Kriegis, RAF POWs of World War II. And you reminded me of a very important anniversary, which is coming up in March 2024. What was that anniversary?
Well, on the 24th of March, 24th and 25th of March, we'll be commemorating the 80th anniversary of the Great Escape. And that was the great breakout, after which 50 airmen were killed by the Gestapo, following a breakout of 76 airmen from Stalag Luft 3, which was one of the most infamous German POW camps. So it's a sad occasion, but it gives us an opportunity to reflect on the lives of those airmen, their captivity, and what it meant to participate in the Great Escape. As you know, and anyone who's read the book, five Australians were killed in the post-escape reprisals. They were Albert Hake, Tom Lee, Reg Kierath, John Williams, and Jimmy Catanar, who was only 22.
The author of the book, The Great Escape, and who was actually there, was an Australian author by the name of Paul Brickhill. Can you give us an overview of the actual escape itself?
Yes, and Paul Brickhill was one of the first to write about the Great Escape. He and a South African journalist published a book in 1946, which sort of talked about how the airmen, you know, sort of arrived in camp, and then this, you know, it was great derring do. But the second half of the book was an outline of the Great Escape. And then later in the early 50s, he rewrote that totally into the book that we know and love, The Great Escape. Well, anyway, as an overview of the escape, almost as soon as Stalag Luft 3 was opened in April 1942, the airmen prisoners of war, or Kriegis as they preferred to call themselves, formed an escape organisation. And this had its antecedents in other prisoner of war camps, in particular Stalag Luft 1, which was located in Bath in Pomerania. Anyway, the organisation, which they called X, or the X organisation, was set up by Wing Commander Harry Wings Day. He was a senior British officer originally. And later on, it was taken over by a really dynamic character, South African-born squadron leader Roger Bushell. And then when North Compound was open in March 1943, he set in motion an absolutely ambitious plan for a mass breakout. Beforehand, they had tried it in, you know, ones, twos, threes, or even groups of, say, 10 or 20. But this was going to be huge. They were going to build three tunnels at the same time to maximise their chances of success, and they were going to get as many men out as they possibly could. They would, their ambition was to create a maximum disruption. And to maintain their secrecy, because one of the strictures of the organisation was that they weren't allowed to talk about it, was that they dubbed the tunnels Tom, Dick and Harry. So, of course, you could talk about going to Tom or working with Dick, and presumably the Germans wouldn't know what they were on about. Anyway, security, as I said, was paramount, and the prisoners didn't speak about their covert work. So even prisoners in the same room perhaps wouldn't have known that their roommate or the person in the bunk below them was involved in some special way. So they all beavered around. They had lots of jobs. There was a tailoring department. Plenty of men worked on forging identity papers. Others stole, purloined, bartered equipment that they could use in the escape organisation. It kept people really busy and engaged. People performed stooge duties, lookout duties, ferreted away dirt. And, yeah, they worked on it for about a year. But despite their secrecy, the Germans found Tom. Later on, they repurposed Dick to store escape equipment, and ultimately Harry remained the main focus of the tunneler's attention. So that was the only tunnel through which they would escape when the time came. Anyway, the breakout was scheduled for the night of the 24th, 25th of March, 1944. They'd been working on it for roughly 12 months. They'd had some breaks because of weather, but yeah, it was basically a year's effort. And as I said, 24th of March, that's 80 years ago. The idea was that 160 Kriegies were going to sneak out of Harry, and there would be 40 reserves, you know, if things went really smoothly and they just rushed through. So up to 200 men, they hoped, would break free. The selection of the escapers was a really complicated process. Those with key roles in the organisation, like Harry Day, for instance, were guaranteed a chance of freedom. And Roger Bushell, of course, and they had early tickets, so they would be out of the tunnel. And the early escapees generally had train tickets. They had forged travel passes. But the ones who were sort of further down, they would have to slog it. They'd be walking through forests and snow, and they were called hard asses. And it really was a hard slog for those men. But anyway, the selection process, key roles guaranteed a chance. Others with particular skills were chosen, for instance, German speakers, because, you know, they had a good chance there. But most of them were picked by ballot. Names went into either a real or metaphorical hat. And they didn't have terribly much notice of the day that they were going to go. So it was all quite a rush. But anyway, on the night of the escape, those with the ticket, they all assembled in Hut 104. The original inhabitants, so to speak, they were dispersed throughout the rest of the compound, and silently, after lights out, anyone with the ticket, they just snuck across the compound and were let in. And they were dressed in clothes made by the tailoring department. They carried their false papers, their false travel warrants, and they had escape food. Not terribly much, because basically it was all they could carry, stuffed in their pockets or some sort of bag. Jimmy Catanar carried a small briefcase, a cardboard briefcase. Some carried blankets, that sort of thing. But basically it's what they stood up with. And they just sat there and waited their turn. And we call it the Great Escape, and that was a name that was actually given to it by Paul Brickhill's publishers. So we call it great, and it really was. It was an absolutely audacious enterprise, you know, to think that you could possibly try and get, you know, dig three tunnels, one complete, and then try and get 200 men out under the Germans' noses, so to speak. And it kept them fully occupied for a year. It gave them a sense of getting one up on the Germans. There was also the morale-lifting hope that those who escaped might just get lucky and get home. It really was a significant enterprise.
You've spoken about a couple of Australians already, but what involvement did we actually have in the escape, and also those who actually got picked to go through?
We actually had quite a lot. said most of the camp or the compound, because it was a North Compound venture, they had some sort of an involvement. Even if they weren't keen on escape personally, they may have got on the roster for soil disposal. So anyway, most of the Australians who were there helped over the months. As I said, they might have been on stooge duties, which was checking the movements of the Germans so that those who were engaged in escape activity, like Albert Hake, for instance, and his friend George Russell, who were making the compasses, you know, they could raise the alert if a German was coming into the hut, and then all the signs of activity would be hurriedly stored away. Others were penguins on the soil removal rosters. They had that crazy kind of, they would stuff soil into pouches hidden under their trousers, and so with some sort of release mechanism let it out. So yeah, they'd be shuffling around. Some of them were on diversion activities, you know, they might be playing sport in the compound. Others dug in soil into their veggie patches. John Williams, he headed the carpentry department. Reg Kirith worked with him there. They were good friends. They had gone to the same school. They had met each other in the Middle East, and they were in the same squadron at various times. And they worked together, and they and their team confiscated bedboards, which were used to shore up the tunnels. And we've all heard stories about, you know, people going to bed and suddenly collapsing through because they didn't have enough bedboards. They helped construct the trolleys, which were used to ferry the escapers to the surface on the night of the breakout. And they also built the secret cabinets so that the escape-related work, such as, you know, the identification papers or the compasses, would be hidden away from the Germans, because they regularly had hut inspections, and they were always sort of poking around trying to find escape material. So they built the cabinets, which were really, really ingeniously constructed. Then on the night of the escape, Wing Commander Norman, who was one of the highest ranking Australians, he ticked off the names of the escapers and, you know, made sure they're in and allocated their place in the escape. And then, of course, we had the Australians who did draw a ticket to escape. So there were a few Australians lined up in the hut. Some, of course, didn't. And there was one person, and I maintained contact with him for quite a few years via email, Alan Raghetti. He was really disheartened at the time that he didn't get a ticket to escape. And, of course, he realised afterwards how privileged he was that he did it, but he was very disappointed at the time. But he was given a really important job, which wasn't really escape related. His friend George Wiley, a very young Canadian boy, had a terrible feeling about the escape, and he gave Alan his watch and photos and asked him to take them home and give them to his family if anything should go wrong. Now, there were plenty of other Canadians in camp who would have been a more sensible choice than Alan, an Australian, who would have to after the war, would have to detour to get to Canada. But Alan accepted this charge. It was, you know, he realised how important it was for young George, and he accepted that. And after the war, and it was a difficult enterprise for him to do, he took the watch and the photos to the family, and he said how it was such an awful experience for them, because they were totally shell-shocked. They had lost their boy. They thought he was safe, as so many people did. They thought he was safe as a prisoner of war. And then to hear that he had died, and in such a terrible way. So they hadn't realised how much of a challenge it was for Alan to fulfil this charge. But he did it. Even in our last email conversations, he still remembered how important that was, and his young friend. And afterwards, in that very important way. So six of our boys went through the tunnel, Harry, and they escaped. So Jimmy Catanar, He was the 23rd. He was the highest ranking, as in numbers out of the tunnel, Australian. He was 23rd, and he was going to travel most of the way by train. And we don't know why he had such a high number, but we think perhaps it was because of his German skills, and also he hadn't learnt Norwegian during captivity. So it's highly possible he was involved in suborning the guards, as in like liaising with them, speaking with them in German, trying to get escape-related materials, but certainly keeping in contact with the Germans. John Williams was number 32. Again, it was quite a high number. And again, that was in recognition of the fact that he had a very pivotal role in the escape organisation. And Reg Kirith, who was his escape partner, was number 35. Paul Royal from Western Australia, he was number 55. This was quite far down the track now, and Paul was a hard arser. He was going to walk to Switzerland. Albert Hake was number 70, and Tom Lee was number 73, and they were all hard arses. And as I was writing the story of the escape, I tried to imagine what it would have been like for them to have crawled through the tunnel and then sort of come up. And the escape tunnel was actually a bit short of the tree line. So they were kind of in view of the watchtower, and they had to run from the mouth of the tunnel to the tree line. So it was sort of a bit of a slow progress there. But I tried to imagine what that wonderful moment was as they crawled out of the tunnel. And fortunately, Paul Royal did speak of it, so I was able to take his words and then just try and imagine it. That sense of freedom that they must have felt after years of captivity, and even knowing that their chances of a clean getaway were slim, just that wondrous moment of, I'm out. And Paul remembered breathing the chilly air because it was winter and it had been snowing. So there was snow on the ground, on the trees. Breathing it in, you would have seen the condensation. He looked up at the stars, and then he turned and looked behind at the watchtower, the guards, and the barbed wire. And then he just thought he'd got this far, and what an achievement. And then he ran across, stood in the tree line, waited for his escape partner, and they set off. But it was, I just tried to imagine that exhilaration that they almost have felt, and mixed up with fear of what was going to happen. Unfortunately, the seventh Australian who crawled into the tunnel, he didn't experience any of that, Paul Fordyce. He was making his way through when the escape was blown. So then he had to scrabble back, and then he got caught up in the pandemonium of trying to hide everything, shut everything down, try and make things look normal. And then as the guards were sweeping through the compound. So he missed out. But and others, of course, waiting for their turn, lost their chance. And one Australian, Albert Comber, who later drew some wonderful pictures, which are in the War Memorial, of some of the Australians involved in the escape activity. And there is a lovely picture of Reg Kirith and his mate, Matt Jones, working in the carpentry department. Anyway, he was waiting, but he'd lost his chance. And he'd actually sadly suffered a number of foiled attempts during his captivity. And when he wrote up this, he just recorded it as failure again. So just the desolation that they felt at the time of being so close and missing out. Yeah. Of course, as I said, in the case of Alan Righetti, for one, they realised how lucky they were. But anyway, of the six Australians who emerged from Harry, Paul Royal was the only survivor. The others, they were killed, along with 45 other of the escapers.
In your book, The Kriegies, the RAF POWs of World War II, you focus on one POW, Jimmy Katnar, and obviously he was one of the six. Can you tell us about him a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really fond of all of the Australians, but Jimmy, there's a real soft spot there. He was from Melbourne, and he was only 20 when he was captured. So very young, 22 when he was killed. He'd had a sterling career with 144 Squadron and 455 Squadron. And that's when I was first introduced to Jimmy, when I was researching 455 Squadron and Jack Davenport, who commanded it at one time. Jack got his chance as a squadron leader because Jimmy was taken POW. So there could have been an entirely different story if Jimmy hadn't been captured. But anyway, that's how I discovered Jimmy. Now, he carried out a number of highly successful bombing operations with both 144 and 455 squadrons. He'd been awarded the DFC, and when he was promoted to squadron leader, he was reputedly the youngest Royal Australian Air Force man to have attained that rank. It was a huge, huge achievement. He was much loved by his family. He was liked by all of his squadron friends. He was particularly admired by his commanding officer, Grant Lindemann, who thought him a first-class man in all respects, and I'm quoting that, and quite outstanding. That really is an impressive accolade. And by the time the squadron headed to Russia to participate in Operation Orita in September 1942, Jimmy had gained a reputation both as a live wire and as an exceptional and experienced pilot. He was full of excitement and verve, popping around. Someone said it was like he was, you know, as a piece of radium, as radioactive as radium. He was just full of life. And when you go through his life story, letters, condolence letters that his father collected, people who knew him and loved him spoke of his vibrancy. It just, you see the potential for this young man to have done so much. Anyway, greatly loved and admired by his squadron. So going to Russia, Operation Orita, the purpose of that was to protect the Allied convoys that were taking important material to Russia. And these convoys were threatened by the Tirpitz. So they were going to Russia and they would fly out on operations to look for the Tirpitz. So the flight to Russia on the 4th of September 1942, it was fraught with danger. It was fully expected that not all of those flying would make it there, as it was just beyond the maximum fuel range of their Hampden torpedo bombers. They encountered bad weather almost from the start, and Jimmy's aircraft went off course. Now, he certainly was running low on fuel, and part of that may have been part of his exuberance when they took off. To help conserve fuel, they were lined up in a very orderly fashion at Sumburg, which was sort of like the furthest airfield that they could get, British airfield. It was very orderly. There was minimum time sort of sitting in the aircraft warming them up. But he just could not wait. He saw a gap and he took off early. So his exuberance was there, and they just thought, well, this is just Jimmy. But anyway, he took off. They were violently off course. It was a terrible flight. His navigator, Bob Anderson, wrote about it afterwards. And it was all Jimmy could do to keep control of the aircraft. But he managed to, and then daylight came and they tried to plot where they were and they couldn't work it out because the maps were no good. They weren't where they were supposed to be. So Jimmy stooged along and tried to work out where they were. And when they did, he tracked a course which would take them to Vienga, which was their destination. But as they tried to regain their course the next morning, they were brought down by enemy fire. They had two choices: try and make it to land or attempt to ditch in the Arctic waters, and that would probably be death. At least if they successfully landed, there was a chance that they would be taken POWs. So it was a group decision. They decided they were going to try for land. So Jimmy touched down quite successfully, but they were captured almost immediately. And a month later, he and his navigator were in Stalagluft 3. Some of his letters written in captivity, extant, they're held in the shrine, the Melbourne Shrine of Remembrance in their collection. And some of them are quite poignant. There's not many of them, so we only have a glimpse of Jimmy's captivity. But we can see in a letter that he wrote to his brother that he blamed himself for their capture. He blamed his own foolishness. He was ashamed that he let it happen, that they became prisoners of war because of him. And we know that, as I said, the flight was a hazardous one. Even if he had have taken off in an orderly fashion, would he have made it anyway? We don't know. It was difficult. He shouldn't have blamed himself, but he did. He was the captain of the Hampden. It was his responsibility, and he was ashamed. But like so many others, he adapted reasonably well to captivity. But, and we see this in his letters, he missed his freedom and he missed his friends. He missed male companionship of the squadron. Even though he's surrounded by people, he still missed the close relationships. And he missed female company. He had a girlfriend in Melbourne. There are letters from plenty of girlfriends after he was captured, wanting to know how he was going, what had happened to him. So he obviously had female friends in Britain. So he missed all of those. He missed his freedom and he missed flying. He took to it, you know, so brilliantly, and he missed it. But he particularly resented the futility of the existence. He knew that his life was on hold, but he tried to engage himself in camp life. He took his turn at cooking and housekeeping. He always offered a friendly smile to newcomers, and that was appreciated because it helped overcome the shock of captivity that they were experiencing. But he also looked to the future. He studied gemology and bookkeeping because he had plans of developing a career in the family business, which still exists in Melbourne, Catanars Jewellers. But he was also toying with the idea of staying in the Air Force. So he had options and he was thinking about them. But as I said before, it seems as if he was planning to escape from an early stage because he studied Norwegian and even got an accreditation from a language school course, what have you, for Norwegian, which arrived after he died. Later on, and these are coming from the letters of condolence, which his father preserved and which are in the Shrine collection, those who knew him weren't surprised that he became involved in such a grand enterprise. They just, you know, because he was so full of life, they thought that, of course, this is Jimmy all over. And it seems that his irrepressibility was I don't know, fostered or stimulated by it. And he was one of the many who actually dropped hints about the escape in their last letters home. He wrote to a friend in England and said, "Get my suit pressed. I'm on my way, so to speak." And then we come to the escape. He was, as I said, 32nd from the tunnel. He planned to catch a train with his escape partner, New Zealander Arnold Christensen. They were heading towards the Danish border where Christensen had relations in Denmark. So they'd get off just beforehand and they'd walk the rest of the way. They'd slog the rest of the way. And he actually had, you know, he probably had envisaged that he had a good chance even on foot, because as a schoolboy, he was a scout. He went to Geelong Grammar and he was part of their scout troop. He was well-versed in scout craft. He loved hiking in the bushland, in the Macedon Ranges. He was really good at it and really into outdoor activities. So he probably felt that he stood a really good chance, certainly would be able to navigate by the stars or with the compass, Albert Hayek's little compass.
So what were the circumstances about his capture and ultimate death then?
Yeah. Okay, so he and Arnold Christensen were captured in Flensburg, which was close to the Danish border. They, and then roughly the same time, two Norwegians, Haldor Espeland and Nils Fuglesang, were captured as well. They were captured by the Kiel Gestapo, taken to the Kiel Gestapo headquarters, and there they were questioned and photographed. And the photograph of Jimmy really is poignant. He's standing there. And one of the things that family and friends all wrote about was how he was, especially his school days, he was always smiling. He was known for this brilliant smile. And in this last photo, of course, he's not smiling. He's looking downcast. He's dressed in his, you know, bodgy POW tailored clothes. And it's a terribly sad final photo. But anyway, so they were interrogated, and then the plan was hatched to kill them. And that this is going back to, you know, the hours after the when the escape became known. Adolf Hitler called a meeting with Goering and Wilhelm Keitel, and he ordered that all of the escapers were going to be killed. And somehow, and I'm not entirely sure, that was discounted, and a round number of 50 was arrived at. But Wilhelm Keitel, so they were ordered to be shot, and orders were sent out. But along with this order was one that Keitel came up with, something Keitel came up with, and that was that after they were shot, the bodies were to be cremated and the ashes were to be sent back to Stalag Luft 3. And this was totally in contravention of the Geneva Convention, as was obviously the shooting, because the Geneva Convention provided for honourable, dignified burial of those who died in captivity. But no, they were going to be cremated, sent the urns would be sent back to Stalag Luft 3, and that would serve, Keitel thought, as an example of what would happen if prisoners of war tried to escape. So anyway, the orders went out that escapers, or some, were going to be killed, and the people were selected arbitrarily. The Kiel Gestapo, you know, the head, ordered somebody to go out and find a secluded spot where four men could be shot, where nobody would see them. And so they went out, scouted a location. And then the four men were bundled into two cars. Jimmy was in the lead car with Johannes Post and Hans Kahler. The other three men were in the second car. Now, as they were driving along, it was only about 8 kilometres from Kiel. The cars were separated, so Jimmy's arrived first. Now, he was told to get out of the car, and apparently, according to war crimes testimony, it was a relatively pleasant trip. Jimmy probably had no idea of what was going to happen. Perhaps he even thought that they were being driven back to Stalag Luft 3, Sagan. But anyway, he was told to get out of the car, stretch his legs, and they were in a meadow, which, even though it was winter, probably looked relatively pleasant. He wandered off. Hans Kahler returned to the vehicle, and he fetched a weapon. Then they led Jimmy through the meadow, and as he walked ahead, one of them took aim and fired. We don't know which one. We don't know who actually killed Jimmy, because later in war crimes testimony, neither would admit to it. And given that they were going to be tried for their lives, it wasn't in their best interest to tell the truth. But we know that someone fired. Jimmy fell forward dead. Then the other car pulled up. The other three prisoners got out. Their hands were cuffed behind them. They saw Jimmy's body and apparently exclaimed, and then they were shot. Then their manacles were removed and the four bodies were unceremoniously dumped on the roadside, hidden from view by a thick hedge. And an hour later, they were shoved into two wooden boxes and transported to Kiel Crematorium. So the thing that gets to me about this is that it was so cold-heartedly planned. The Kiel Gestapo personnel deliberately planned it. because that was their orders. They knew it was against the Geneva Convention. They colluded to get their story straight because they knew eventually that they would be questioned about it. And they swore an oath, clasping their hands. It's written as a hand clasp in the testimony to seal the story that they would later tell, to claim that it was the truth. But, of course, it wasn't. And then later, when they were questioned by the war crimes investigators, Johannes Post sketched a diagram of where the POWs were standing and where their bodies were then moved to. And I've included those sketches in Kriegis, which tells of the story of the Great Escape from the Australian perspective. And whenever I look at them, I just find them incredibly moving and horribly callous. It's an appalling record of the life and death of four young men. And those men, of course, have names, but they virtually stand representative for all of the 50 great escapers who lost their lives, because we don't know exactly what happened to all of them.
Out of the five Australians that were killed, were they all cremated?
Or every one of the 50 were cremated, and all of the ashes were put in little urns, and they were labelled with numbers, names, and sometimes the location. So they were shipped back to Stalag-Luft 3 as Keitel had ordered, and they sort of in dribs and drabs. They didn't all arrive at the same time because they had got all through the Reich when they were fleeing. So they went as far as Flensburg in Jimmy's case. So, the French border, all over the place. So they were lined up on a trestle table. And rather than an example of what would happen to them, the men looked at them, and of course they were grieving, but they saw these with the locations on them as proof of the maximum disruption, as in how far the men had got, and the great brouhaha, because there was a huge escape or search effort had been launched. So they saw it as evidence of the disruption that they had created. It's quite incredible to put aside grief and put that spin on this evidence. It didn't seem to occur to them that cremation was against the Geneva Convention. But even so, the urns arrived and they stood in the stead of bodies. Now, when they first found out about the deaths, those in camp were horrified, they were appalled, they were shocked, especially when they were told that they were all shot attempting to escape and no one was wounded. And the senior British officer, Martin Massey, asked for the bodies to be returned so that they could bury them in the camp cemetery, bury them with their fellows, others who had died. But, of course, the bodies didn't arrive. The ashes did. So the Kriegis then decided that they would build a funerary vault to house them. All of the ashes would go together in this vault. The Germans gave permission. They even provided the materials. So over the following months, and this is from May 1944 through to December 1944. So we've gone through summer where they're reasonably fit, and we're getting into winter again. But we're in the latter stages of the war, where after D-Day, and the Germans were starting to suffer and rations were not coming through. So a lot of the men were starting to become debilitated, and they had to have a roster to preserve the energy of the men participating. But anyway, they built, and it is beautiful, a funerary vault. And some of the Australians helped construct this. Or they worked in the garden because they landscaped it. And the names of the 50 were engraved on three granite panels. It was designed so that there would be granite lids which could be lifted, and the urns were placed in. Then the lids, mighty heavy lids, protected them inside. After The camp was evacuated in January 1945 ahead of the Russian advance. They didn't take the urns with them. They stayed in the vault. Now, as the Russians advanced, some broke into the vault apparently in search of gold, and some of the urns were broken and the ashes were scattered. After the war, the remaining urns and what could be collected of the fallen ashes were removed because there was no guarantee, and because this was now Eastern Bloc territory, there was no guarantee of continued safety of the ashes. So they were removed and interred in the British Military Cemetery, which is now Old Garrison Cemetery in Poznan. And they were all buried together, or almost all of them. Those with complete urns were buried as in an individual grave with an individual headstone, just as we see in any Commonwealth war grave cemetery. Those with whose ashes had been intermingled on the floor, like Jimmy Catanar's, were interred in a collective grave. But they were still given individual headstones, so we still have the vision or the image of individual corporeal burial, because there's nothing there to indicate that these are ashes. We as we look at them, we assume that this is that the bodily remains of the great escapers, and 48 of them are there. The two exceptions are Dennis Street, whose remains are in the Berlin Military Cemetery, and those of Nils Fugelsang, who was captured with Jimmy or at the same time, which were repatriated to Norway. So most of them remain together. Like, you know, if you think of the Great War cemeteries, for instance, quite often you've got men from the same battalion buried together. Mm. Comrades in camp, comrades in the escape, they're buried together. Mm. Which I don't know. It's a lovely thought, and it means that if you are visiting and you're paying respects, not to your family member, but to all of the escapers, because it was a joint enterprise. There may have been individual motives, but it was a joint enterprise.
And as we said, this month, or March 2024, is the 80th anniversary commemoration of the Great Escape. Do we know how, either in Europe or wherever, how will the escape be commemorated?
Well, I don't know if there's anything happening in Australia. I haven't heard. I do know that the Shrine will be, sometime round about then, we'll be having a podcast about Jimmy Catanar, actually. In Poland, at the camp, there will be a commemoration. I understand that there are British tour groups who will be going. Various family members, people connected with the escapers, will be making what is essentially a pilgrimage to the camp. But I certainly don't know if there's anything specific happening in Australia. I think the main thing will be that people will be remembering, family members will be remembering in their hearts their own family member, the loss and what it means to them. And other people who are connected to Stalag Luft 3 will be thinking privately of, you know, the sadness of the lives that were lost. Mm. Only the human cost for it, because only three made it back to England. Back to England. Only three out of the 76 who got out. But even so, despite that human cost, the survivors, those who remained in camp, they believed that the escape was important. They didn't regret it, despite the lives lost, because of what they saw as that disruption that it created. And it made them feel that they were still participating in the war, that they were fulfilling their duty as airmen. They were still part of the Air Force, part of the war effort, and a commitment to hindering the enemy. And so lives were lost, but their lives had meaning. And certainly those lives were positioned after the war as a sacrifice. Those men, Jimmy included, had died. Their deaths were considered sacrifices. That it was part of the war effort, and their lives were nobly given.
Yeah. And as we've as we said at the start of the podcast, a lot of people can read about this in your book. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
and when we did speak to you again last year about your book, but can you remind people, if they want to grab a copy of your book, where can they get it from?
Yeah, they can get it via me at Alexander Fax Booksellers. If they're in Australia, they can also buy it from the War Memorial. Signed copies are available there, or via Booktopia. If they don't live in Australia, they can get it via Amazon. And, of course, the ebook is available on Amazon, which a lot of people are finding it more easy to read these days. So it's out there. You won't find it if you walk into Dimmicks, but it's available on some online.
And you can you can go back to our podcast and have a listen to you about our book again. And look, thank you.
I wouldn't be surprised if you link this one to the previous podcast.
Absolutely. So we've been talking about The Great Escape. It's the 80th anniversary of The Great Escape, which occurred in March 1944. Kristen, always great to talk. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure as ever.
That's the podcast for today. We're keen to hear your feedback by leaving a review on your podcast app, because your reviews helps new listeners find our podcast. And you can help support this podcast via Patreon or Buy Me a Coffee. The links are on our website and Facebook page, and your support helps us with the production of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your service.